scarred hands before him in his lap and scowled. "You are 22 years old," he murmured. "When I was your age, I was stood aboard the ship on the Clyde hiding from the redcoats, and your mother was in steerage waiting for me. She would have followed me to hell if I had asked. You think you want to know about the world, boy? You don't." William felt himself blush. "When you need to know the story of Edward Shade," his father said quietly, "I'll tell it to you myself." Many decades later, at a police conference in Nebraska, William would speak of those years with a kind of sadness for what had been lost. "Don't mistake me," he would say, raising a glass to his lips. "The outlaws and hold-up men were killers and no good to anyone. Mostly boys too lazy to work and too full of bravado. In the southwest and middle borderlands, especially, most of them were daredevils home from the Civil War, without much future to make up for the past." William would frown and study the cuffs of his dinner jacket, as if lost to memory, and then his eyes would clear and he would look at the young commissioner seated to his left and say, "That war did nothing but corrupt the boys of a generation, sir. You can't cut a man in half day after day and come out of it normal. I know men fit for nothing but the slaughter yards after it was over." He would cut a small, bloody forkful of steak and chew it delicately, and wipe at his mustache with a monogrammed napkin and then grimace. "Well, they were clever, for all that. The outlaws in those years. No, dynamite wasn't in use until the 1890s. But No. 4 black powder coarse grain could break up the doors of an express car and blow off your fingers to boot, as well as any stick ever made." He would hear a weariness in his voice that he could not place, and he would swallow it back down while the electric chandeliers burned on. "It wasn't a federal crime in those years," he would add. "Express cars were private property. A gang could cross state and county lines and vanish into amnesty. I guess that's how we got involved. How my father got involved." He would listen politely to some query or other then and nod, a huge, thick horror of a man with his grey eyes, moist, and the crow's feet at their corners betraying long days in a saddle under hard suns. His great hands liver-spotted and trembling, which once had outdrawn outlaws. "Well, it wasn't quite like that," he would reply. He would nod in silence, and when the other had finished he would say, "But the express safes were supposed to be burglar-proof. There was always a guard in the car with them, and even he didn't have the combination. They were locked in New York or Chicago and not opened again until they got to where they were going. Oh, and we weren't often at a loss. You could learn a lot from the cut where a safe was dumped or a train stopped. How many riders? Anything of interest about the horses or the men? The first thing was always to ascertain if any railroad employees had been seen in the area. No, we had a network of sheriffs and peace officers, and they were enterprising enough. Our agency never accepted the rewards, you see, only our usual fee." "I said rewards, sir. Don't get me started on rewards." He would be thick in the waist by then, a heavy, powerful man with broad shoulders and a mustache stained to rust from long tobacco. He would fold his napkin and set it on his plate and blink his tired eyes. "Well, we were organized by that time," he would go on, though he was never garrulous and would come to prefer solitude to company. He could speak well when he must. He would say, "In the early years, our contacts would send descriptions of outlaws and their associates to our offices in Denver and Chicago. Sometimes they'd even send a photograph. That was how we recognized John Reno and his brother Frank. Most of those boys loved to have their pictures taken. They wanted to be known, you see. Yes, we had all sorts. Saloon keepers, ranchers, railroad men, miners. You'd be surprised. Nothing was too trivial. My father used to say a ranch hand's gossip was worth more to him than a dozen news reports. Well, he was fascinated by rumors, I guess." And he would go quiet then, and study the scrapings of his plate, remembering. The hotel was located 6 blocks from the rail yards, and the two men, father and son, made their way out into the rain with their oilskin coats turned up and their heads low, trudging through the mud of Central Avenue towards the river with a bow-legged gait, each one, and the grim, unfussy approach of men well acquainted with violence. The rain came in at a low slant, and the outlines of horses could be seen huddled to one side of the hitching posts. William regarded the thin orange glow from the hurricane lamps on the porch reflecting off their haunches, and casting their crooked shadows out into the ruts and black pools of the street, and he blinked the water from his eyes and went on. It was a cold, ropey rain that chapped the knuckles and roared the wrists, and William regretted his gloves packed in his trunk at the hotel. The Enfield he had rolled in oilskin to keep the powder dry, and carried it low at his side. His father coughed and turned from the rain and spat, then stepped up onto the clattering boardwalk and went into the depot. They wore two pistols apiece, and they kept their heads both. It was a small room with a low fire burning in a brazier at its center, and a wicket against one wall, and beechwood benches set back to back, running the length of it. It stood near empty but for the five operatives lounging with papers opened and pipe stems bristling from their jaws, and their hats wilting beside them or hooked over their knees. They were big men, each one, the better of William, but when they saw his father, they got anxiously to their feet. "All right, lads," his father said, looking up at them. "It's not time yet." He swung off his hat and beat the rain from it and put it back on. The rain was dripping from the hem of William's oilskin, and he stood in a puddle on the floor, wiping water from his face and stamping the muck from his boots. Anything might go wrong on the morrow, and he knew any one of these men might not come out of it, and he wondered again what sort it was elected such work for pay, and what trust could mean to those who traded in flesh. His father was going among the men, a nod, a clasp on the shoulder, the common touch. "Has Mr. Bangs been in yet?" he asked. "He were just here, Mr. Pinkerton, sir," one of the men said. A mouth wide as the base of a bottle, crooked yellow teeth like piano keys. His eyes were grim. "Where is he now?" William asked. The men looked at him then, and he saw in their faces something thin and hard and severe. "Is he back at the post office?" his father asked.
"Yes, sir," a second man replied. "Mr. Pinkerton, what is it we're here to do, sir?"
the first man asked.
The father peered across at the son.
"Willie!"
William met his father's eye. "We'll tell you when it's time," he said curtly, and then he regarded the men. "It's unlikely to be tonight, but be ready for it all the same." A shuffling of boots, much muttering and knuckles working in pockets. William looked again at his father and set the rifle down on the bench, then went back out. He walked up forth and crossed Elm in the whirling rain, then hopped back up out of the mud on the far side, and stamped his boots, and opened the door of the post office and stepped through. It was warm in there, with the fire going, and Bangs was seated on a bench under a poster, advertising condensed milk, and the miracle cures of Mr. Bill Macken's goat cheese, and he looked up as William came in.
"Nothing."
Bangs looped his spectacles back on, glanced at the clerk. Green eyeshade and gartered sleeves, an awed pencil tucked up behind one ear. Examining some paper laid out before him with a too strained intent. Then Bangs stood and gestured William out onto the porch, and the bell rang and the door swung shut behind them.
"Everyone still in place?" Bangs said.
William nodded.
"I think today's a bust," Bangs said. "There's only the one express left, and that's within the hour."
He was a small man, an ugly man. Walked with his left foot turned in and his left hand contorted into a claw, and shoved into his coat pocket from an injury sustained before the war. As a boy, William had feared him. He had small teeth, not visible when he spoke, so that only the tip of a pale tongue could be seen moving in the black, and when he laughed, his thin lips gaped open like the gills on a trout. Pocked cheeks from some childhood illness, hard green eyes behind crooked eyeglasses. He had been a journalist once, and a guard at New York's Crystal Palace after that, and he had balanced the agency's books since its founding 13 years earlier.
"How's Margaret?"
he asked now, staring across at the lights of the depot.
"Still beautiful," William said. "Still fed up."
Bang smiled.
"A woman like that likes to have her fellow close to home."
"He likes to be there."
"Well."
Bangs nodded.
"This'll be done with soon enough."
"It's the waiting I hate."
The rain was easing now, the wind turning to the south. William folded both arms over the railing and clasped his frozen hands.
The gaslights of the opera house were burning across the street, casting cones of light along the stone facade. He could hear the heavy waters of the Ohio churning far off in the darkness. He said, "You think we can trust this, Winscott?"
"I think so."
William thought about it, and then he said, "Tell me about Edward Shade."
"You should ask your father about that."
"I'm asking you." The older man, despite his ruined appearance, was a hard and stubborn man. He seemed to be turning it over in his head, and after a moment he shrugged as if he had decided something, and then he said,
"What do you want to know?"
"What happened in 66? Bangs adjusted his spectacles with one finger. He said,
"An express train robbery in New York. The guard had fallen asleep and the thieves cut a hole into the door and clubbed him over the head while the train was moving at speed. And then they jumped from the car and ran off. The guard was found unconscious with froth at his lips. There wasn't much to work from. The rough cuts around the door, some slivers of soap in the floorboards. But we had a feeling something was wrong. At one point, the guard named a tunnel in the Bronx the train had just entered, right before the thieves struck. But if he was asleep in a windowless express car, how could he have known that? He cracked, confessed to being a confederate of the thieves, and admitted rubbing soap on his lips to create the froth. The thieves were two men we hadn't known before, Crakes and Stone, and we traced them up to Toronto and arrested them and brought them south. We found a serrated knife in their room that matched the cuts around the express car door and had them sent down to the jail in White Plains, New York. The strange thing was that everyone we talked to insisted there had been a third man with them in Toronto, a man with a dark complexion and a scar on his face, a man named Edward." William nodded. "It wasn't Edward Shade," Bang said. "There was no reason to think it."
"But my father thought it."
"You must have heard about this."
William was shaking his head. "Did you track the man, this Edward?" Bang smiled ruefully.
3 weeks after the arrests, someone dug a tunnel under the jail and Creeks and Stone escaped and we couldn't find them anywhere. Then a month later, the Boylston Bank in Boston was broken into using the same kind of tunnel, and over $1 million worth of securities was seized. It was Creeks and Stone again, of course. By this time your father was furious and sent 24 operatives in to find them, but whoever was in charge, maybe it was this Edward figure. He was too clever for that. He approached Boylston's manager indirectly using a crooked attorney and offered to work back the securities to the bank for a fraction of their value. The bank agreed. I guess they thought it was cheaper than paying for our investigation. We couldn't do anything. We think there were 4 of them on that Boylston job. Crakes and Stone, who were known to us, an English cracksman, and this mysterious Edward. All 4 of them sailed for Europe out of Canada, and we could only watch them go.
What's about the stolen amounts?
All of it worked back. Every dime.
William was puzzled. I don't understand, he said quietly. So what's all this about Shade?
Bangs was shaking his head and fumbling in his pocket for his pipe, but when he pulled it out, it was wet, and he started to shake it dry, and then gave up.
Mr. Bangs.
Look, kid, Bangs said. He's your father, and I admire him more than any man living. But everyone gets it wrong once in a while. Here's what happened. A witness identified a third man running from the express train. Said he was this tall and looked like so, with a scar on his face like so. Dark skin, like a half-Mexican. A similar man was seen in White Plains. No question. An informant in New York gives us the name Edward. And when we canvass the bank manager in Boston, he claims a wealthy Mexican, who was so tall, with a scar on his cheek, was seen opening a new account 2 weeks before the heist.
Okay.
Bangs gave him a look. Each of the witnesses said they saw the scar. Later, every one of them retracted it. Both Crakes and Stones had thick beards, if that's what you're thinking. It wasn't either of them. Sometimes people think they see things, and it turns out later to be, well, you know.
Wrong.
Yes. My father doesn't want to talk about it. He's embarrassed, I guess.
Was it very bad?
Bangs tilted his hat back from his forehead. There were jokes about it in the Police Gazette in New York. He said, at Christmas somebody mailed him a present of sticking plaster.
for shaving cats. It was kept out of the dailies, thank God. It could have been worse.
You think so?
You don't? Bangs pushed himself upright from the railing, his bad arm hunched in the cold. He said,
"Worse doesn't come into it, kid. Not for your father. You know why we're here, don't you?
To take John Reno." Bang stared out at the rain.
"John Reno," he murmured. "Sure."
They waited all through the evening and slept badly in their clothes, with their boots and coats beside their beds, and then waited all through the morning and afternoon of the following day. William could feel his father's impatience. The rain had blown past in the night, and the city was crowded with clerks coming out of the counting houses, and coaches mired in the muck, and ladies holding their skirts in disgust. He could not still himself, and he paced under the big windows of the hotel lobby, watching the doors for word, and going to the station, and coming back. And in the afternoon, as the daylight was again failing, the telegram at last came through.
"It's a go,"
he told his father with a rush. His father merely grunted. Dick Winscott would have John Reno on the Seymour platform, awaiting the 4:10 postal express that day. William and his father came at a run into the waiting room of the Cincinnati and Indianapolis to find the big men watching the rail yards and adjusting their hats, and the depot clerk regarding them with a disapproving air. Then the door clattered open behind them, and Bangs was shuffling in out of the cold with a scarf double-wrapped around his neck and his eyes afire.
"You're ready?" he said.
His father glanced at the men standing behind him, and William could feel his excitement.
"Is the car coupled?"
his father said. Bangs nodded. He took William's hand at the door and wished him luck.
"It's not us who needs it," William said.
He winked. "Don't wait up," and tipped his hat and went out. Railroad men call it a ghost special. It crouched on the rails in the cold, snorting a great cloud of steam like some terror out of an older age. A heavy 8-coupled tender locomotive accustomed to hauling freight, its boiler the size of a barn. There were pigeons scattering up near the smoke box and landing and picking at some spill of feed in the loading bays, despite the dark and the cold. And William blew out his cheeks and felt the first of his misgivings. Some of the men were already aboard, and others were hauling coils of rope from the sheds beside the tracks. That engine had been built for power by the Grant Locomotive Works and sold to the B&O in 1867, and William's father had borrowed it for its speed. It gleamed black in the gloom, with its gold and red trim, startling to William's eye, and a great clattering of pistons as the firebox was stoked and the boiler cranked up to capacity. His father did not want John Reno to know what was coming down the track, and so the tender had been coupled only to a single passenger car, and the fireman now leaned out of the cab and gave them a grim nod, and the men clambered aboard. And then, like that, the brakes unclamped with a jolt, and the wheels loosed, and the twin pistons punched and spun. William took one last look at the station, then trotted alongside and swung up and in. It was an old velvet-lined carriage smelling of smoke and sweat, with seats arranged along each wall in the manner of an omnibus, and brass rails for their boots, and webbing slung overhead for baggage, and a weak gas lamp burning at each corner of the car. William stood with his father at the front, while the men got seated, and he was the last to sit, and no man gave him more than a glance. His father did not sit, but stood in the aisle with one hand out on either side of him, gripping the posts for balance, and regarding the men.
"If you know me, you know I'm not one for speechifying," his father was saying.
The big locomotive rattled up out of the hollows, the grey Ohio sliding past on one side.
"Tonight we mean to go into Seymour, Indiana, and take John Reno out by force," his father said. "This should go simple and without complications. You'll follow me when we come into the platform and stay close. Don't engage until we're in place, and then don't hesitate. You know his reputation."
William felt the car shunt and shift on the tracks, and they were moving now at speed through the extinguishing afternoon.
"There'll be a man with him, a saloon keeper named of Winscott," his father said. "We don't want him. He's not a killer by all reports, but if he gets in the way..."
He left the words hanging, and the men nodded amongst themselves. Reno's not too particular about killing, so you'll want to be fast. He ran a hand across his mouth as if thinking about something, and then he added, I've told the driver to go in hard, and to get out at speed, and he's given us 3 minutes on the outside, before the postal express comes up on him. You know what that means, lads. Two of the men were checking their revolvers. William watched their deft hands at play. Click, swivel, turn, click, and the glint of metal winking there. Is any of that not clear? His father was saying. Mr. Wyatt! The man with the yellow teeth and wide mouth turned his face from the window and nodded.
Sir.
I want you to keep an especial eye on his guns. He'll have two and a knife in his boot, if our information is correct. Mr. Miller! A man bearded and broad-trunked and heavy-browed as a lumberjack, with a great mane of reddish hair, shuffled his boots and grunted. He sat with his hands on his knees, and his big thighs splayed out over two seats, and his gut sagging over his belt. Mr. Miller, I want you to shackle the fellow. William will take his arms from the back, and when he does so, you get his wrists into the irons. The big Hessian nodded. His father reached into his waistcoat. Here is a photograph of John Reno taken last spring in Seymour. The nearest man took it wordlessly and unfolded it, then passed it on. There's nothing about this man you should like or take kindly to, his father added. He's killed and stolen and done in just about every kind of honest citizen you can name, and he's never thought twice about it. If you have a sister, or a wife, or a mother, this is the man she goes to sleep at night scared of. William did not look at the photograph, but handed it across to the man behind him. His father took out his pocket watch, cradled it in his palm. You have 34 minutes, lads, he said. Do what you need to do. William followed his father's gaze. The sun was low in the sky and had backlit the street clouds into a red, inflamed welt of light. Welcome to Seymour, his father shouted. William could feel an electricity go through the carriage then, and when his eyes shifted to the face reflected in the window, he saw neither dread nor joy nor excitement, but something else which he did not recognize, and only many years later would understand was the look terror took on in the eyes of a 22-year-old boy. He thought of his wife at home, and of his new daughter in her crib, and he realized there was no part of him that wanted to leave this earth. The riders at the depot in Seymour were killers, and would shoot without hesitation, and, like his father, he did not believe John Reno would be without associates on that platform. What troubled him was the not knowing. He would not know a member of Reno's gang to see him, and could run right past a hand in a waistcoat, or a knife in a fist, none the wiser. When he raised his eyes, his father was looking at him. 3 minutes, his father hollered over the sound of the locomotive. Remember, we get in and grab him and get out. If there's no need to make a fuss, we don't make one. William could feel himself nodding despite himself, and he blinked hard and peered again at his fists. There was a loose thread on the cuff of his coat, and he tugged at it and tried to think of nothing at all. They came around a curve and slowed. The platform hove into view. All right, his father was shouting. Mr. Wyatt, Mr. Muller, William, you exit from the front with me. I want the rest of you out through the back. Keep your heads. William felt a foreboding come over him. The platform was crowded with men and ladies in bonnets and bustles, all of them awaiting the 4:10 postal express. He stared the length of the narrow platform, but recognized no face. They came in past the water tower and a small wooden outbuilding, once painted blue, but weathered now, and peeling in the cold, and they were still at such speed, William thought for a moment they would overshoot the station, until the carriage jolted sharply in a quick sequence of breakings, and they came to a snorting halt in the center of that crowd. His father was glancing from the faces on the platform to the photograph in his hand, to the faces again, and then he shouted, There, in the blue duster, at the back of the platform! William looked but could not see. The men were already up and moving heavily, their boots clattering in the aisle, and the floor juddering under them. William swung down behind Muller with Wyatt at his back, and they cut single file through that crowd of onlookers, the more curious turning to regard them as they passed. The air smelled of rain and horses.
He could not see where he was going and kept close to the Hessian, and then the crowds parted, and he saw the other men had formed a loose circle around two figures, bent in conversation, neither of whom had yet looked up. He saw his father step forward and speak some word, and the bigger of the two men glanced up and went for his gun. It was that fast. William lunged in from the back and grabbed Reno around the chest, and one arm broke free, but then he had him. He was pinioning his arms to his sides, and Mullo was leaning into the fray, twisting the outlaw's wrists and locking the iron handcuffs into place. The man was writhing, and William tasted tar and spit and sweat in his neck, and he had his face crushed up against the back of the man's head when Reno leaned forward, then smashed his skull back into William's brow. He staggered, dazed, but he did not let go. Then Wyatt stepped in and struck Reno twice with his fists, and reached down and slid the man's pistols from his belt with a soft liquid clatter, and William's father was knocking Reno's hat from his head and shoving an empty flour sack down over the twisting fury. The crowds had drawn back in confusion. Reno was shouting from within the sack, and William scanned the faces for sign of any Confederate, but he could see only terror. Winscott was hollering bloody murder at them and grabbing for the arms of the nearest man, and Wyatt stepped forward and set two strong hands on the middle of Winscott's chest and shoved him hard, and he went backward into the crowd. All this William saw as he looked wildly about, but he was already dragging the kicking man backward on his heels, and Muller was fighting to get a hold of one boot, and then a second man had seized the other, and they carried him like that through the recoiling crowds at a half run, as if he were a sack of feed.
"God damn it!" his father was shouting. "Get a move on! Go!"
William thought he saw a cattleman in the crowd pushing towards them, and he did not see his father, and then the cattleman went down, and then they were hauling Reno, still squirming, up into the passenger car. When he turned, he could see over Reno's thrashing legs his father behind them again. Winscott had pulled a knife, and he watched his father turn and get in close to Winscott with one strong arm, and with the other he hammered at him sharply on the skull with the butt of his revolver, and the man's legs went out from under him, like a calf on new ice, and he collapsed with the blood already in his eyes. Then his father was running for the buckboard and hauling himself up and waving to the conductor, and they were away. On board, the men were whooping and slapping their hats against their legs and banging each other on the back, and William turned from them to lean out the window and watch the platform shrink into distance. He could see no sign of pursuit. His heart was still battering in his chest, and he was breathing through his mouth as he made his way down the swaying carriage to the rear. John Reno, in the flesh, wrists in iron bracelets at his back. He had been tied and double-tied in a long winding zigzag of new white rope until he looked like a package of beef strung up for transport. His hat had been lost in the melee, and his long black hair was greasy and standing in clumps on his scalp, and his mouth and left eye were swollen. Muller was holding him by the arms to keep him from sliding onto the floor. William sat, hooked a thumb in his waistcoat, nodded to Muller. The Hessian grinned back. He could feel his own uneasiness as he studied the outlaw. The men were still laughing and hooting near the front of the carriage, and passing a bottle amongst themselves, and after a moment his father came down the aisle. He held the creased photograph for the outlaw to see, took off his coat and folded it over the seat behind him, then sat down, and William watched the big man's eyes shift to take in the two revolvers at his hips.
"You don't know what you just done," the man said. "This ain't even legal."
His father raised his eyebrows, smiled across at his son.
"You look at me,"
Reno shouted suddenly. His father looked. The big outlaw had gone very surly, very dark.
"My name is John Reno, and my brothers is Frank and Simeon, and you give us two pistols apiece, we ain't afraid of no man living."
"Wonderful," his father said. Reno turned his head and spat. His gums were bleeding. William's father leaned in.
"Do you know who I am, John?"
Reno grinned a bloody grin.
"You're a corpse with boots on."
Wyatt hollered from the front of the carriage.
"What's that collar you wear, Johnny boy? There's a judge in Gallatin mighty curious."
Reno said nothing.
You may fear no man, his father said quietly, but you will fear me.
The carriage clattered and shivered. William swayed in his seat. Muller's knuckles were white where they gripped Reno's arms.
You ain't the law, Reno said.
No.
His father was no longer smiling. Reno turned his face, stared out at the passing fields. Beyond the windows, the Midwest plains were vanishing, and William could see the distant orange glimmer of a settlement. The passenger car darkened further.
Now I'm going to describe a man to ye, his father was saying softly. I'm going to describe a man, and I want you to tell me if you ever heard of him.
In that first fall after Margaret's death, he would sit alone in the evenings with a stack of his late father's books beside him and reread the popular tales of the Eye That Never Slept, and in the reading he would once more hear, faint, under the crickets and the slicing wind in the long grass, the rasping, half-articulated voice of his father. His own hands liver-spotted and old. His father, he knew, had not written those books, but there it was, all the same. He would hear his father's shouted defense of his female operatives, see again the froth and spit as he stormed out of his office, or his father's crumpling of receipt dockets, and shouting down George Bangs's protestations. He thought of his father like a tide washing in and receding, and leaving some polished strangeness behind in the sand, evidence of some other world. His father at his country house, striding out in all weathers on his 12-mile walk, or coming downstairs with his cheekbones red and steel-grey hair soaking the back of his collar from the cold bath he would take each morning. All that, and the long, brooding evening train journeys in which his father would turn to the glass and study his own watery reflection, and speak to him over the clatter of the tracks, about the nature of the hidden, and of what might be seen by any who would choose to see it. William knew his father did not believe in the invisible world, but he would understand only very slowly in those years that his father was thinking of the phantom, Edward Shade. In none of those books was there any word of such a figure, real or imagined. William had at one time believed this to be the shame of a man ridiculed, but as he grew older, he would come to think otherwise. He would come to believe his father wanted the story of Shade for himself, wanted to keep close and secret the delicious possibility of Shade's existence, even into his final years. And as his father grew the more frail, he would take to sitting in the garden among the flowers, his square head nodding, and William would sit with him in silence watching the bees work the roses. And it would seem to him sometimes that a third sat with them, some ghost his father's glance would shift to, shift from. In the end, the old man in his confusion would look up at his son in astonishment, then lift a trembling hand and lay it upon his son's knee, and murmur, his eyes wet,
"Oh, I have been looking for you such a long time, sir."
And William would say nothing. All that, too, would fade to sepia and fog. William's own eyesight would begin to weaken. In his dotage he would turn the pages of his father's books with his feet set square on the ground and his knees apart. And he would look out at the fields and think of that day in Seymour when his father took John Reno and the Western Outlaws were born in blood and lead, and he would shake his head for the madness of all that had happened once, all that was real. 3 days after delivering John Reno to the courthouse in Gallatin, Missouri, William opened the gate of his house in Chicago and waded the deep snow of the lane and stropped the ice from his boots on the porch steps with his suitcase standing between his legs and one hand on the frozen railing, and looked up in time to see through the lighted windows of his living room his wife in her nightgown, dancing with another man. Standing in the cold, the air burning his lungs. That man was her brother just in from California, and he knew this, and yet still the sight of it pained him. He swayed there in the snow-swept darkness for a long time, surprised by the hurt he felt. His face was wet. His hands were wet. At last he watched her brother bow in an exaggerated fashion, the orange light catching in his whiskers, and his wife curtsied, and then the man lit an oil lamp and went upstairs. William stood with his breath steaming out before him, and frost crackling in his hair, and he waited, and when his wife had gone through into the back kitchen, he picked up his suitcase and crunched down off the porch,
and around to the rear of the house, and he went in. She was 20 years old that winter, and as beautiful a creature as any he had seen. She had strong white hands, and a long throat, and hair the color of sunlight on a shallow stream bed in summer. Her voice was low for a woman, and this was something he had always loved about her. They had been married 1 year, and already he could not imagine any life other. When he shut the door behind him, she was staring at him in amazement, with both hands gripping the back of a kitchen chair. She looked so young, so much a girl, still.
"Surprise?"
he said.
"Good Lord, you gave me a fright, William,"
she breathed. She went to him and pulled his head down and kissed him, and he pulled back and wiped the snow from his mustache, and she kissed him again.
"Good Lord,"
she said again.
"What are you doing here? I thought you said tomorrow. I would have had something laid out for you. I was just about to go up to bed.
David just went up." She put a hand to her mouth.
"David's here,"
she said.
"It's all right.
I know. We have stew," she was saying. "Are you hungry?" She paused then. She gave him a strange look.
"How long were you out there?"
He shrugged.
"Let me get a look at you,"
she said. He stood obligingly.
"You weren't shot?"
"No, ma'am."
"Well, that was clever of you. You still have all your teeth."
"Yes, ma'am."
She was silent a long moment then, and then she said,
"Oh, William, oh, you look so tired."
He did not know what to say to that.
"Here, sit,"
she said. She took his hat from him and helped him from his oilskin, then folded it dripping over one arm and went into the parlor. A puddle was forming under his boots, and he scraped them on the roughage mat laid down just inside the door.
"I said sit,"
she called from the front hall. He sat. She came back in.
"Never mind about David," she was saying. "David can wait. There's plenty of time for visiting."
She set a saucepan on the stove and unpinned the cheesecloth from the top of the day-old stew and ladled some out and opened the stove door and stoked the coals, and using the poker, she shut the door with a clang.
"How's the baby?"
he said, watching her. She smiled without turning.
"When she's fed, she's happy. She's missed you."
He nodded. "David's got plans for a boarding house in San Francisco. He's going to talk to you about it tomorrow. I think he's looking for investors."
"Investors?"
"Just go easy on him," she said. "I like to see him like this. He's hopeful."
"He's something."
She poured him a glass of milk and set it before him at the table, and laid out knife and fork and plate, and then she gave him a long, appraising look.
"So is it done then?"
she asked.
"Is it finished?"
He shook his head.
"You have to go back."
He opened his hands in a gesture he had learned from his father.
"There are still the others," he said. "Frank's the real trouble. I expect he'll take over now his brother's been taken."
"Will they try to get him back?"
"If they don't, I'll look a fool."
"No, you won't."
"I will. I told my father to expect it."
William glanced at her. He set out his big hands on the table and closed his eyes.
"It's not the Renos I'm worried about," he said tiredly. "The whole country out there is angry. There'll be a vigilante mob 500 strong if the governor's not careful."
"Your father'd like that."
William opened his eyes. She came over to him and nudged the table clear of his chair with her hip so that she could sit in his lap, and then she sat and folded her arms around his neck. She wrinkled her nose.
"I haven't washed," he said.
He put his hands on her waist as if to lift her, but he did not yet.
"And what does Mr. William Pinkerton think of it?"
she said.
"Of what?"
"Of vigilante justice. Do you agree with your father?"
He frowned and peered at her, but said nothing. When he saw she was in earnest, he said,
"My father was born in a place where justice had nothing to do with the law."
"You think it's different here?"
"I think it could be."
She kissed him softly.
"Good answer,"
she said. He kept his eyes on her as she got up and smoothed her skirts.
"Hiya," he said. "Come back here, you."
She slapped at him with the dishcloth.
"Watch those hands. I'm married, you know."
"You got a sister?"
"I thought you were hungry."
"I thought so, too."
"Well," she said, "aren't you going to ask what I think?"
"About what?"
She gave him a look.
"Okay,"
he said. What do you think, Mrs. Pinkerton, of a mob breaking into a courthouse and dragging a man out by his boots and stringing him up without a trial?
I'm glad you asked, she said. I don't think I like it. No, sir.
His gaze drifted over to the stove where the pot of stew was simmering, but she was not finished. Her voice went serious. She said, sometimes when you're asleep and having a bad dream, you make this little whimpering sound, like a pigeon.
A pigeon?
She puckered her lips and cooed, cooed.
I never.
You do so. I have to reach over and shake you by the shoulder. You don't wake up, but you roll over. I guess the dream changes.
At least you stop whimpering.
I don't whimper, he said.
She seemed so very beautiful, smiling at him in her heavy winter gown, her hair down her back in that long, thick Celtic braid.
I think that's what this country is like right now, she was saying. It doesn't want to know about justice. It's there. It's just not a part of the dream. But it could be. We're asleep, and when the whimpering gets too loud, something will come along and shake us out of it, into a different dream.
William rubbed at his face.
Or maybe we'll wake up.
No one wakes up. Not really. You still want that stew?
He grunted.
You aren't hungry?
He smiled.
My jaw's getting tired.
She put a hand on the back of his neck, and it felt warm and clean and right to him. He put his own rough hand up, and they stayed like that a moment as the snow whirled down in the silent blackness beyond the windows, and the oil lamps dimmed.
You look tired, he said after a while.
I feel tired.
He twisted in his chair, put his arms around her.
I don't mind tired in a girl, just so long as she's got green eyes.
You got green eyes?
You know what color they are.
He pressed his face into her neck, smelled her hair. He was still a young man. His entire life lay before him. The house creaked in the darkness.
That's all right, he murmured. They don't need to be green.
Inventing the Devil, 1885, London. 13. William woke with his fingers creeping through the cold scoop of his bedsheets, missing his wife. All night and into the morning, the man from the tunnel had come to him, a crescent of light etching a cheekbone, a splinter of whiskers, that sorrowful, liquid darkness in his eye. Fool. Adam Fool. He opened his eyes, breathing, remembering the grief that man had kept under control on behalf of a woman he had loved. He thought of Margaret in their blankets on winter mornings, fitting her bed slippers to her feet, while the mattress shuddered gently under. She hated how her body had thickened after the children, but he did not mind it, and he loved the soft heat of it still. A weak daylight was leaking through the curtains, and he kicked clear of his blankets, crossed the freezing floor, poured cold water from the carafe at the basin and wrung out the flannel and began to wash. Shade was likely dead, howsoever his death had found him. Shaw believed it. The man Fool claimed it, different though each account did prove. Margaret would ask him what was in his heart. He had learned over a lifetime to trust her counsel, and his own thoughts did refract and clear in the hearing of it. He thought of Adam Fool's quiet, sure grief as he leveled his accusation against William's father. The hell with it. What was in his heart? His heart told him the Saracen was real, though there was no reason to believe it, and though the mudlark Muck Annie was most likely decomposing in some churchyard lime pit. Could his father have killed Edward Shade? He knew what Margaret would say.
I loved your father too, Willie. But that man was capable of anything.
He had been 15 years old when he fell in love with the eldest Aisling sister, blonde, vain, flighty. For months he could not see beyond her dazzle to any girl else. Dreamily he would skip his classes at Notre Dame, buy her chocolates, roses. That sister's name was Alice, and she would swoon in his arms and brush her lips against his jaw like a heroine in an English novel, and he felt his own new raw strength course through his arms as she did so. Alice Aisling would go riding with two of her schoolgirl friends in the public parks in the afternoons, and William would stand with a hand on the trunk of a sycamore, watching her canter and turn and canter past again. staring at him boldly, smiling the while, her girlfriends all a-giggle and calling her away. That was in October of 1861. In November, she danced all evening with an older boy of 19, already an officer in the Northern Cavalry, while William lurked at the edge of the wax floor and crushed the flower in his lapel. William was desperate, devastated. Visions of his own enlistment in D.C., where his father was gathering intelligence, visions of some heroic act under fire in a cornfield of Virginia. All of it nonsense. When he rubbed at his wet eyes and turned away, there was a younger girl standing beside him, white dress, flowers wreathing her hair. He almost knew her. The night deepened, the dance floor tilted and drained away. Together they watched Alice curl into the officer's arms.
"That's the wrong sister for you, Pinkerton," the girl said.
And then he knew her. Margaret Ashling, 14 years old, quiet and lovely, smiling a sardonic smile at him from under her lashes. She held out a tiny hand for him to take. To his surprise, he took it.
"How lucky you are, sir, that I happen to be an excellent dancer," she said, guiding him towards the bandshell while the violin swelled around them. "You just follow my lead."
Margaret loved to tell that story. Whenever friends asked how he had found her, she would give William a cool smile and say,
"Oh, he didn't find me."
At which he would shake his head, reach for her hand, and laugh. "How did I find her?" he would grin. "I found her difficult and stubborn and headstrong." At the hotel desk in the green light under the low-hanging fronds, he rapped a knuckle on the counter and waited. But when the clerk checked, there had not been any telegram from Chicago. He frowned. He was more interested than ever to hear if his description of Adam Fool's manservant matched any in the agency files, and if there were any record of his employer, Fool. He thought of that man's slight frame, his shadowed skin, the eyes like amethysts pressed in wax. As the doorman held open the great glass door and the cold roar of the street sucked at him, he buttoned his Chesterfield and hunched his shoulders and strode through. Even after 20 years of detective work, he found himself confused by his own nature and the havoc it could wreak. He would confess freely his fascination with the criminal world, his fondness for rogues of all stripes, his equally determined desire to mete out justice in a fist or at the end of a rope. Margaret thought his fearlessness, his introspection, his restlessness, all emergent from the same dark and molten core, a love for a father whom he did not think loved him rightly back. "It's a hard thing, learning to love the man you are," she would tell him, running her fingers through his hair of a night. "Goodness isn't dependent on anyone's approval, Willie." William jogged across the street, pushed through into the warm restaurant with its Restoration-era moldings and steamed windows. A wood fire was burning in a great hearth at either end of the dining room, bracketing the empty tables. What he wanted was to talk to Margaret about the man Fool. What he wanted to chart was the cast of her silence. He was seated at the far end of the room with his back to the fire and his deep-set eyes watching the door through force of habit when the waiter came, fussed, went. Adam Fool's mention of his father and shade would not let him alone. He thought it likely he was being manipulated, and yet the man claimed an intimacy with Charlotte Reckitt, and she, of anyone, might have known how Shade died. William frowned. He was a man who trusted his gut over his head, and had learned to do so by measuring the quarts of his own blood spilled. There were facts, and then there were facts, he knew. "If you draw a spid," his father liked to say, "don't try to play clubs." He unfolded his napkin across his lap and studied the tablecloth and asked himself, as he had asked his entire life, what his father would do. The sky was white, a white sun burning a sightless funnel through the haze. He caught John Shore in the narrow lane of Great Scotland Yard, just leaving. A cold wind crackled around them, riffled the loose papers stuffed under Shore's elbow. The chief inspector shook his harried head, glanced anxiously in the direction he had been proceeding. "Jonathan Cooper," he muttered. "Oh, I remember him. Whole generation of us came up in the yard hearing stories about Cooper. The Saracen, he was called. What's your interest in it?" William shrugged. "It's probably nothing." I'm late as it is. Walk with me. Shaw started off at a clip, and William jogged to catch him. Maybe 10, 15 years back, he said. Head started turning up in the Thames. 19 of them in the end, one shy of a nice round number. The chief shrugged, his face red, breathing hard as he went. A lot of murders go unreported around here. A lot go unsolved. A lot are never written up. At least they used not to be. The curious thing about these heads is that the bodies were never found, and the heads all had the same kind of cut, some rough, ragged chop. I'm told it was a very distinct cut. Like the Reckitt woman's. Shaw slowed. Is that what this is about? A market cart clattered past, trailing cuttings of cabbage. Two small urchins with rags tied to their feet with twine were following, darting between the legs of the horses, snatching up the leavings in the cold. So he was real, William said. Cooper existed. Cooper didn't do in Charlotte Reckitt, William. The man's been disappeared for 10 years at least. He's in his grave by now. Is that fact? Shaw waved at a passing hansom, but it did not stop. I never saw a body, if that's what you mean, but I'd stake my reputation on it. A man like that doesn't just stop killing. What are you up to, William? William did not answer. He said instead, What can you tell me about him? Not much. He was a big bugger. He served in the Crimea with a raiding force of Bashi Bazooks. They'd burn the Russian villages and cut off the heads of the Christians. Women, children, all of them. The heads were thrown into the Danube. Floated the whole bloody way down to Varna, where the English and French were camped, and Allard started picking them out of the reeds with boat hooks. But by the time the raiding party got back to Varna, the cholera had struck, and the French camp had set up pickets to keep the English sick out. I guess it was a mess. I guess the army wanted to keep the whole matter quiet. Cooper wasn't court-martialed, but he fell sick on the boats when the army sailed for Alma. He must have recovered in time to go into the fight, or maybe the army just thought it was an easy way to solve the problem of what to do with him. A musket ball tore up his face in the first assault, entered through his left cheek and came out at the right corner of his mouth, and took 23 of his teeth and a good part of his tongue with it. That was in a vineyard before they'd even reached the river. He'd climbed a tree to get a bead on the enemy. It said he was left hanging there for hours by his feet before he managed to get down and go looking for a staff surgeon. Somehow he didn't die. Shaw gave him a long, tired, appraising look. You really want to know about this? A hansom cab stopped at the curb and Shaw clambered up. Leave it alone, William. He called over his shoulder. That's my advice to you. William held up a hand and took a step back. The driver leaned forward with his loop of reins and then, on a whim, William stepped swiftly up and set a hand on the door and leaned in. One last thing. Ever hear of a man named Adam Fool? Adam Fool. Claire, the driver called angrily. Claire, off now. Fool. Yes, William said. Shaw grunted. Never heard of him. What's he? William started to answer and then looked off down the street and let go the hansom and stepped back. No one, he said. In the afternoon he returned to the Grand Metropolitan. The polished marble columns, the hush, four knuckles rapping twice on a mahogany counter, while across the gleaming floor a gentleman under a palm lifted his face from a newspaper, startled spectacles glinting. The desk clerk was deferential, tugging at his cuffs. Ah! Still no telegram from Chicago, Mr. Pinkerton, sir? No. William cracked the vertebrae in his neck, wondering if the delay meant much or little. Upstairs in his rooms he scraped his shoes tiredly and did not take off his Chesterfield, but collected the files on Shade and Charlotte Reckitt and carried them down to the smoking lounge on the second floor. High windows, long Persian carpets, long bulleted sofas, empty at that hour but for two gentlemen in a blue cloud of smoke, well out of earshot. William seated himself before the fire, the day's whiteness blooming through the curtains. He was looking for any word or description that might match Adam Fool in either file, or verify the man's accusation, but after an hour he still had nothing. Was Fool speaking as an accomplice of Shade? He thought it unlikely. Charlotte Reckitt, he knew, was the probable source of the man's story. And yet fools calling Shade a boy had the ring of truth to it. It wasn't the war that killed that boy. William unfolded his legs and plucked at the knees of his trousers and fanned the files out before him. He picked up the rogue's gallery photograph of Charlotte Reckitt. Youthful, cold, brutal. Hooded eyes unkind. A wide mouth. Raven hair pulled flat for the camera. He shut the file. Whatever else, he had not lied about the Saracen. William knew that did not make the man or his other claims trustworthy. But it was something. As for Cooper, the Saracen, if there was any truth to him at all, then he was worth attending to. That would require blueprints to the sewer tunnels downriver from Blackfriars, and William wondered briefly at which city offices he ought to make his inquiries. He knew Breck would be prying apart the microscopic secrets of Charlotte Reckitt's flesh, even now, and turning up some hint, perhaps, as to the Saracen's whereabouts. William started to loosen his collar, and then he caught himself and stared at the carpet, smiling angrily. The Saracen's whereabouts, he thought. So you believe it, after all. Just then the gentleman's laughter drifted across. Bright, watery, false. William grimaced. He realized what it was about the man fool. 10 years gone, and their marriage never realized. And what would he, William, do, were Margaret to be killed? Would his heart too chart such disaster, such ruin? The dignified grief in the man astonished him. He told himself he would risk the same, given such calamity, but he could not be sure. All this he saw without seeing, and he thought of his ancient father in the reading room of the new city library in Chicago, turning the pages of some report that did not require his attention, the stiff, watermarked papers rustling. A vision, 2 years past, and that man never again to be seen on this earth. William belled his tongue against his cheek, closed his eyes. A man knows nothing of himself, he thought, until he is tested. And then? He opened his eyes. And then, God help him, whatsoever he choose to do. Long nights, wearying nights. On Tuesday, William rose tiredly and washed and dressed and ate, and at 10 o'clock made his way by hansom to the Metropolitan Board of Works. The mist was brown, murky, room after room of smouldering fog closing up around him. London, he thought in disgust, wiping his handkerchief along his throat. The traffic was thick, the going slow. He got down at Trafalgar Square and walked the mile in haste, until he reached Spring Gardens. He entered the works building already irritated and tired. At the reception office, he gave his card and asked to see the official responsible for sewer oversight, and explained, in a low, flat voice, that it was a police matter. The clerk regarded him skeptically, but directed him along the hall to the next apartment, and there he again gave his card, and explained his purpose, and there he was told, again unimpressed, to seat himself and wait. An old woman was asleep on the chair, facing him, black hairs a-sprout her upper lip, her low snoring somehow consoling. He closed his own eyes. There was something in that old woman, some resigned fortitude, that made William think of his mother. An hour passed. Clerks came and went. As the second hour closed, he rose again and again inquired, and was again told, coldly, that he would be attended to in time. He wondered if he should have enlisted Shaw's help. At noon, the old lady snorted awake and slid out from under her feet a small hamper that contained a roll of bread, a twist of sausage. She ate with her eyes downcast, her dry, thin lips chewing rapidly like a rabbit. Then she leaned back, folded her arms, shut her eyes again. At last a rumpled clerk came out, blinking. William glimpsed behind him rows of copying clerks, waistcoated, in gartered sleeves, their diligent heads bowed. The man was clutching the door handle in an oddly effeminate manner, wrist turned back. Williams's card held out before him in his other hand, as if it were an unwashed thing. "Mr. Pinkerton," he called, peering about as if William were not the only man there. William got to his feet, his muscles stiff. "Here," he said. He stepped forward, looming. He lowered his voice. I've come about plans for the sewer tunnels.
I know what you are here for, sir. The Basil Gett plans, yes?
William did not know what a Basil Gett might be.
It's a police matter, you say?
William nodded. There was, in the clerk's fussiness, something he instantly disliked.
Chief Inspector Shaw sent me, he lied.
The clerk studied his signs, his calloused hands, his long dark mustaches. His fingernail flicked Williams's visiting card. Flick, flick.
But you are not with the Yard yourself.
Obviously not, William said, impatience creeping into his voice.
The man raised his eyebrows.
I'm an American detective, William added, forcing himself calm. Our agencies are working a case together.
He felt a growing irritation with the small man, his self-importance.
For God's sake, man, I've been waiting here hours. Is all this necessary? You can show me a copy of the plans, or you can show me to your superior. Either will do.
There was a smugness to the clerk as he apologized.
But surely Mr. Shaw knows that the MBW does not keep its plans at Spring Gardens, Mr. Pinkerton, he said.
I can't imagine what he was thinking, sending you here.
What are you saying?
You'll want the Public Record Office on Chancery Lane, sir. The public consulting room there for research matters.
The clerk gave him a veiled shake of the head that made William want to punch him.
You'll bring your credentials, of course, sir. Perhaps a letter of introduction from Mr. Shaw would be of assistance.
The hell with the letter, William told himself. The hell with the damned English bureaucracy.
An hour later he was entering the Public Record Office off Chancery Lane, still in a black mood, the winter afternoon already extinguishing behind him. An old man in woolens with the fingers cut out and blowing on his hands for the cold squinted up at him, his pale eyes unfocused.
Can't never get warm in here, he whispered. Not never, sir, no.
William feared him mad, but then the man cleared his throat and said, in a high-pitched voice,
Yes, yes, and what is it you came for, then?
Records of public works, William said cautiously.
Sewer plans, actually. The old man nodded and led him down a long gaslit hall to an empty room filled with tables, haphazard chairs, muttering the while.
You a writer too, then?
He asked.
A what?
That Mr. Dickens come here regular once. I remember him well, I do. We used to talk about songbirds. We both liked them birds of a season. Fascinating man, that Mr. Dickens. Don't much care for his writing, though.
William shook his head, removed his hat, set it down on a table.
Is there someone I can see about plans for the sewer lines? He asked. It's a police matter.
Oh, them sewer lines always is,
the old man said mysteriously. But he disappeared with William's card back into the hall, and shortly afterwards a plump, hairless man in a green waistcoat came through, cod-like eyes abulge. William started to explain himself again, but the man waved William's visiting card in his direction and held up a hand to stop him.
I know who you are, Mr. Pinkerton, sir, he said. What is it I can do for you?
William liked him at once. The plans he brought out from a locked records room were rolled and tied off with twine, and the man set them down on a tilted drafting table and clipped them into place and smoothed them down with soft fingertips. He said,
It's not the main line, but the street line you'll be wanting, sir. These are the drafted plans drawn up by Mr. Basil Gett, sir, as he had hoped to build the lines, but the construction often had to make do, sir. What's here and what's down there, he said,
jabbing a squat thumb at the floor,
are not really the same thing at all. Oh, it's no one's fault, sir. There were chambers and rooms and old sewer tunnels already in place in some instances. They just used what they could find, shored it up, following the spirits of the plans the while. You said it was for police use.
That's right.
This here,
and the clerk riffled through the papers until he had found the sheet he sought, this is the branch line that runs down towards the Thames below Blackfriars Bridge.
You can see the outflow chambers, sir. This one and this one. I know for a fact that this tunnel was never built. It should